fighting against this carnal soul, if he wants to be a man, if he wants to be a true human being, if he wants to reach the lofty values of a true human being, you have to practice over and over again.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor 'cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
If a CEO of a huge corporation does not practice before that corporation becomes a billion-dollar corporation, before that the corporation becomes a million-dollar corporation, if that person X, the CEO, does not practice on himself to be humble towards the staff members, being humble towards people outside in the society, towards his taxi driver, towards the people who receive him, the people in the hotel, the people who serve him in the VIP section in the airplane, the people who serve him everywhere, if he does not practice early on in his career to be humble, that will be very, very hard for him to practice those techniques when he becomes the CEO of a huge corporation later on. So we have to practice right now. Right now is the moment to practice and being humble towards anyone, towards the sweeper who sweeps the street, your alley. When you pass him, you send your salam to him. You send your peace greeting to him. Ask how he is. When you see the doorkeeper, send your salam to him. Anyone that is not usually seen as an important person, even the children, send your salam to them first. Greet them first before they greet you. Crush your ego, crush your arrogance as much as possible, and see it as daily practices. Daily practice every single day. When you see a child, you send your salam first. And I can even go further than that. But you can practice these techniques if you want to rectify your values, if you want to demolish this feeling of arrogance which is growing within us. It could be working hand in hand or side by side with a nurse with unclean things. These things would help you. It could be to drive and give plastic bags of food to people. Crush your arrogance as much as possible, and you will see that other doors will open up for you, opportunities will open up for you, a light will shine within you. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us all in practicing these tools, these techniques. Until next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. All I need.
In the limelight.
The Yemeni Minister of Health says the military onslaught by Saudi Arabia and its regional allies has claimed the lives of over 3,800 Yemeni children in the crisis-hit Arab country. Whilst more than 400,000 minors are acutely malnourished and require urgent care. Speaking at an annual medical conference in the capital Sana'a recently, Taha al-Mutawakkil said children are among the groups that suffer the most as a result of the Saudi-led aggression and siege of Yemen, noting more than half of children in Yemen are severely malnourished, and the military alliance does not shy away from targeting children's hospitals. The Yemeni health minister, Taha Mutawakkil, then pointed to the Saudi-led air attack that hit a school bus at a crowded market in the northern Yemeni province of Sa'dar back on 9th of August 2018. That attack martyred 51 people, including 40 children, saying the strike is a clear example of the extent of crimes being perpetrated by the Saudi-led military alliance against Yemeni children. He also criticized as a great shame the decision by UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres on 15th of June to remove the Saudi Arabia-led military coalition from an annual blacklist of child killers. We now present you an article written by Rosemary Misdery under the heading Story of One-Year-Old Abdullah is Story of Yemen. The article was published on npr.org's website. Please stay with us for more of Rosemary Misdery's article. As Muhammad Yusuf tries to calm his crying son, he says, "Losing my child whilst I'm watching is breaking my heart." He added, "I feel so worried for my son. I won't rest until my son is completely healed." Muhammad Yusuf lives in Yemen. His one-year-old son, Abdullah, has been at a health facility in Sana'a, the capital city, where doctors are feeding him reconstituted milk from powder formulated for children with malnutrition to keep him alive. Abdullah's attending clinician, Dr. Abdul Malik Muhammad, says on 5th of December he weighed just 6 pounds on his fifth day of treatment for severe acute malnutrition. That's less than one-third of the average weight for his age. The doctor's diagnosis of severe acute malnutrition is a medical classification reserved for the worst cases of malnutrition. Yusuf and his wife, Fadia, traveled 15 hours by bus through dozens of military checkpoints to bring their child to the medical facility in Sana'a, the capital. According to the United Nations reports, in Yemen today, nearly half of children are severely malnourished. The five-year-old war in Yemen has caused the country to plunge deeper and deeper into poverty, poverty that has been exacerbated by floods and locusts. And even when there is food available, a three-year-old Saudi-led blockade restricts goods coming into the country by land, sea and air. The resulting delays increase the cost of basic necessities like food. And for many Yemenis, any price is too high. Yusuf lost his job as a farm labourer last year when farmers couldn't get diesel required to run the pumps for irrigation and drinking water because of fuel shortages caused by the war. Now his family depends completely on aid, which he says allows them to eat one small daily meal. In fact, 80% of Yemenis are dependent on aid, and it's often not enough to avert tragedy. Yusuf says his two older children died of malnutrition, his firstborn at the age of 6 months, and his second child at the age of 4 months. He says both children died during treatment at a health center near their rural village in Taiz, which he says lacked basic medicine and medical staff. Samuel Mabuto, a nutritionist specializing in severe child malnutrition for the humanitarian group International Medical Corps, says fighting in Taiz makes it difficult for parents to get medical attention for their children. Samuel Mabuto has worked through two previous famines, first in his native Uganda and then in southern Sudan. He says children and conditions in Yemen are much worse because the blockade restricts access to aid. This is his third year in Yemen. During his 9 years of practice, Samuel Mabuto has measured the arm circumference of many children, a major indicator of malnutrition. He uses a small tape measure-like device called a MUAC tape, mid-upper arm circumference. He wraps it around the child's arm like a hospital bracelet, inserting the end of the tape into a slot and pulling it through to adjust to the width of the arm. If the arm circumference is in the range of about 5 to 10 inches, the child is in the green zone, indicating a healthy size. From 4.5 to 5 inches on the tape is a narrow yellow section that indicates moderate malnutrition. Then the MUAC tape is red from 4.5 inches until it ends. When children measure in the red zone, they have severe malnutrition. Samuel Mabuto has seen arms that measure as little as 3 inches around in Yemen. At the 27 facilities where Mabuto manages nutritional programs, he says that nearly all the children he sees measures in the yellow and red parts of the tape. Samuel Mabuto says the signs of malnutrition are evident in their sunken eyes, in cases of diarrhea, ribs protruding in sharp relief, and knees like chicken drumsticks. Mabuto says once the child is sick, their faces show sadness. The mother is also sad. Then you see signs of hopelessness, adding, they don't know what will happen the next day. He says recovery can require up to 2 months of close monitoring and feeding. Other doctors interviewed by NPR have witnessed similar distress. Dr. Wafa Al-Salali leads a team of nutritionists for International Medical Corps in southern Yemen. She says most of the children admitted to their health center are severe cases of malnutrition. Her colleague, Thuraya Salam, a nutritional nurse in western Yemen, says the feeding centers are crowded and malnutrition cases are compounded by cholera and diphtheria. Wafa Al-Salali says, when I see the children in the feeding ward, I'm fearful and worried, adding, watching the collapse and weakness of the health system is the most difficult thing for me as a doctor during the war. At the health center in Sana'a, Dr. Muhammad measures and weighs children during visiting hours. He tells NPR he believes the one-year-old Abdullah with an arm measurement of just 3.2 inches will survive. The doctor says a few beds away is a severe case that he thinks will also survive, a 16-month-old infant called Zayed Ali. After a month of treatment, Zayed Ali weighs the same as Abdullah, 6 pounds. With an arm circumference that measures just 2.8 inches. The doctor has seen an influx of families traveling from distant rural areas of the country seeking medical care for their children in the capital, Sana'a. He says it's a significant indication to him that malnutrition has worsened in Yemen. Samuel Mabutu says even if a child, like one-year-old Abdullah, survives and is discharged from the feeding center, his parents will still have to continue his feeding treatment at home. And if there is a lack of food at home, it is likely the child will relapse. The UN predicts the situation in Yemen will worsen. It projects a famine in the next 6 months, with well over half the country malnourished. Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, in a statement last month warned that Yemen is now in imminent danger of the worst famine the world has seen for decades. Antonio Guterres added, "In the absence of immediate action, millions of Yemeni lives may be lost." Dr. Muhammad, who sees only a couple of beds free in the feeding ward where he works, for now says the famine already exists, adding, "It has gotten worse to the point that it has become out of control." The Yemeni Minister of Health says the military onslaught by Saudi Arabia and its regional allies has claimed the lives of over 3,800 Yemeni children in the crisis-hit Arab country, where more than 400,000 minors are acutely malnourished and require urgent care. Speaking at an annual medical conference in the capital, Sana'a, recently, the Yemeni health minister, Taha al-Mutawakkil, said children are among the groups that suffer the most as a result of the Saudi-led aggression and siege, noting more than half of children in Yemen are severely malnourished. And the military alliance does not shy away from targeting Yemeni children's hospitals. The Yemeni health minister, Mutawakkil, then pointed to the Saudi-led air attack that hit a school bus at a crowded market in the northern Yemeni province of Sa'dar back on 9th of August 2018. That brutal attack martyred 51 people, including 40 Yemeni school children. Dr. Mutawakkil said the strike, that airstrike, is a clear example of the extent of crimes being perpetrated by the Saudi-led military alliance against Yemeni children. He also criticized as a great shame a decision by the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres on 15th of June to remove Saudi Arabia-led military coalition from an annual blacklist of child killers. Dr. Mutawakkil said the previous regime did not offer any medical facilities concerning pediatric medicine and surgery. The high rate of congenital malformation among Yemeni children is due to weapons being used by the Saudi-led coalition and its bombardment campaign. The Yemeni health minister, Dr. Taha Mutawakkil, went on to lambast the UN's negligence, stating that the world body has so far failed to take any measures to save the lives of conjoined twins who were born recently at Al-Sabeen Hospital in Yemen. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015, with the goal of bringing the government of former fugitive President Abdurrabba Mansour Hadi back to power and crushing the popular Ansar Allah movement in Yemen. Earlier this month, the United Nations Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Aid, OCHA, put the death toll from the Saudi-led war in Yemen at 233,000. The Ansar Allah movement, backed by the Yemeni army, has been defending Yemen against the Saudi-led assault, preventing the aggressors from fulfilling their objectives of an atrocious war.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Agent Orange, a chemical cocktail that became notorious as a defoliant, was used in aerial bombardments against the Viet Cong in the Vietnam War. The U.S. military sprayed millions of gallons of Agent Orange onto Vietnam's jungles during the conflict to expose northern communist troops. 40 years since the end of the war, people in Vietnam with severe mental and physical disabilities still feel the lingering effects of Agent Orange. Its legacy of death and deformity is well documented. Cancer and birth defects amongst both Vietnamese and U.S. veterans have been linked to exposure to the defoliant. But what is less known is how Agent Orange was used after the war. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Agent Orange is made up of the chemicals 245T and 24D. In the 1960s and 70s in Australia, the solution used in weed eradication often involved the spraying of herbicides 245T and 24D with terrifying consequences. Sprayers were often exposed to the deadly poison without any protective gear. Many sprayers died young, one after another. But still, this is not the full extent of the problems caused by the chemicals. Stay with us as we meet the families of former government employees who have died almost certainly as a result of their exposure.
One-year-old Nigel Sinclair is in the last stage of terminal cancer.
Yes.
Nigel and his family believe he's soon to be the latest legacy from a chemical exposure which they say has killed his father, his uncle, and many of their mates. Before Nigel dies, he wants to know how a tragedy like this could happen.
At this very late stage, what would be the very best outcome for you?
It's like answers, really, just to someone and I can rest, and I can rest, and my family can rest and put it to rest.
I'm lucky that he's still with us and still going. He has his moment where he'd like to have his closure.
Back in the 1970s and 1980s, hundreds of men were employed by the various state governments around the country to spray noxious weeds. Today, many are sick and many are dead.
A lot of the boys end up being the same, fading away near enough to nothing. doctors turn and just, feed your medication, kill the pain. You're right, you'll be right. And next thing you know, they're dead.
Nigel's father was one of about 320 men in the West Australian Kimberley who sprayed herbicides for the state's Agriculture Protection Board, or APB. Now, there are reports of the sprayer's partners and children getting sick.
I think that they should have a close look, epidemiologically and clinically, at the children of those APB workers. I think that they should suspect that they'll have huge problems to deal with.
Mr. Hunter, Nigel's father, was one of many Indigenous men who joined the government spraying teams.
They work from sun up to sundown for what pay they got, little knowing that they're going to die later on in later years.
What the men didn't know was the herbicides they were spraying from backpacks were the same chemicals used to make Agent Orange in the Vietnam War. 245T and 24D, which were contaminated with dangerous dioxins.
Poison was carried on the same vehicle as their water drums and their swags and everything. They used to get soaked with the poison. They slept in it, worked in it for 10 days at a time. And all their clothes will get washed at home.
It wasn't an accidental spill on any workday. Their bodies were exposed to the herbicide all day, and I'm not talking about 8 hours in the day, but 24 hours a day, every week, for months and years. I can't conceive of anywhere where the exposure has been so intense and at such a level and for so long.
One of the workers, Carl Drysdale, said they would cart the drums of chemicals in the back of a four-wheel drive. The sprayers would go into the bush for 10 days at a time. For the first few years, the men were given no protective clothing.
Most of the people would be wearing what was appropriate for the heat, which would be shorts and thongs and T-shirts, you know.
A few years after spraying the chemicals, many of the men began to get sick.
Now, in the beginning, what were you told about the chemicals? How safe were they?
Harmless. So harmless you could drink it.
That's what they told you?
That's right.
Who told you that?
Oh, all the bosses, all the head sharanks.
But Carl Drysdale, who was the foreman, felt responsible for his men, and he was getting worried.
They all got rashes, everybody got rashes, headaches, and I guess internal bleeding was another pretty universal thing, like they were vomiting blood and passing blood.
Carl wrote to his superiors in June 1982 about his concerns. A manager from the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board wrote back saying that 245T was not considered dangerous if used as recommended, and that he did not support staff undertaking their own research.
You're told that the stuff's harmless, so you think, well, you know, I'm probably wrong, so you give them the benefit of the doubt, you know? And that was a mistake to trust the government, you know?
The job was a perfect job for them, and they loved that kind of environment. Maybe if it had been a white person, they most probably would have stood up and said, well, I'm not spraying this, this doesn't smell nice, I'm getting a rash, I'm getting sores, I'm not touching this anymore. Well, if they wouldn't, they didn't want to lose their job.
After years of spraying, Mr. Hunter became so ill that he could no longer work and was often bedridden. He had sores all over his body, respiratory problems, dramatic weight loss, and extreme fatigue.
His black arms were dyed white or bleached white where that poison came in contact. He had great big lumps under his jaw, from his glands, under his arms, and he told me in his groin. His general health was so bad that he couldn't get up the stairs at work to get his pay.
At 33, Mr. Hunter died in his sleep. He was the first of the Kimberley men to die, but others soon followed.
many of those men are still alive?
Not very many. And if any, they're sick. Sick today.
Mainly headaches at the moment, yeah.
For more than 30 years, Carl Drysdale has been fighting to get workers' compensation for the surviving men.
Kept me awake all night last night.
When are you going to see
the doctor?
Carl himself has not been able to work since 1985 because of a range of illnesses he believes were linked to the sprain. His wife Marion has had to support him and their four children.
Carl has suffered from just about everything you can suffer from, and I've seen the physical decline in this powerful, energetic man since he finished with the APB.
I had like constant heart attacks, unconscious. They told my wife I was going to die over and over again. 5 black spots on my lungs. I've used cortisone cream for rashes that's ruined my bones.
Okay. I need to hold it level with your heart there. Okay.
Dr. Randolph Spargo was a local GP and saw many of the sprayers, including Carl Drysdale.
So it's definitely abnormal, Carl, but much better than used to be.
Have you got any doubt all these years later that it was the chemicals that made a lot of these men sick and in some cases killed them?
No doubt about it. I wouldn't go near that herbicide.
The herbicides were contaminated with dangerous dioxins. Chemical Industries Kwinana in Perth imported some of these chemicals, which were supplied to the West Australian Agriculture Protection Board.
According to the normal toxicity...
In 1978, Four Corners reporter Andrew Olley interviewed the owner, the late Robert Telford.
But it's not a commercial problem.
What do you mean it's not a commercial problem?
It's because it's not possible for a person using commercial 245T containing these minute infinitesimal quantities of dioxin to be poisoned by them.
How do you know that?
The toxicity becomes meaningless in the dilution.
A few years later, Professor Ben Salinger, a former head of chemistry at the Australian National University, traced some of the chemicals to Singapore, where one batch had been fire damaged.
The normal herbicide would have been light in colour and fairly fluid. The sample we had from the tariff board was clunky and black, so it would appear that there was a good chance they were using the stuff that we also looked at.
All of a sudden, at least 30, 44 gallon drums of concentrate arrived, and it was completely different to the stuff in the 20 litre drums. The stuff in the 20 litre drums was like engine oil or honey, you know, colour. And the next lot came, it was black and thick, and it blocked up all the nozzles. And 30 drums was enough for at least 20 years.
Tests on a sample of the fire-damaged chemical later revealed it had 200 times the allowable level of dioxin then, and more than 2,000 times the levels permitted in later years.
Well, I think it would have been very dangerous. It was much higher than what was used in Vietnam. And at those levels, I think they were really exposed to a high level of risk.
The men continued to die.
They die with that sort of lingering question mark hanging over, why has this happened to me, you know? And to see that is terrible.
In 2001, occupational work specialist Dr. Andrew Harper was asked to investigate if the men's illnesses were linked to chemical exposure. Dr. Harper says the government's Agriculture Protection Board repeatedly failed in its duty of care.
One, they were not trained. Two, there wasn't an induction program. The information about the risk was not given to them. The supervision was not there. And they were not given, in the main, safety equipment. So they simply went out in shorts and shirts and thongs, and that was it. And there wasn't any systematic washing after exposure. So they were just completely exposed. And the authorities didn't take a responsible stand to, in fact, correct the situation.
Dr. Harper recommended all those who were sick be considered for compensation.
I recommended that compensation be considered, as I felt there had been a disservice done to these people. And it wasn't only manifest in a specific illness, which was difficult to define. It was manifest through the way they were treated and through the impact that that had on their lives and on their feelings of alienation.
But the West Australian Labor government responded to Dr. Harper's recommendation by calling for another report.
Asking for a scientific study created a distraction from the content of my report.
That the men be compensated.
That the men be compensated. It diverted attention away from all of the injustices of the whole program. It diverted attention away from the suffering that these people had, and it diverted attention away from the moral issues that the whole thing exemplifies.
Former Agricultural Minister Kim Chance commissioned the new report.
Harper's report took us a long way because we began from a situation where we were trying to uncover the results of an event that occurred 20 years before. Harper's report allowed us to tie those events together. He said, look, it looks like there's a cause and effect issue here.
He was a lot stronger than that. He recommended that you consider compensation for all those men.
Yes.
He found a failure of duty of care by various governments.
Yes.
He found that there was no protective clothing, that these chemicals were suspected of being incredibly toxic, and no training. Why did you need statistics to compensate the men when you had all that before you?
Because our means of compensation is the WorkSafe principles or the WorkCover principles. That's the only means we have of compensating a former government worker.
I'd like to get a jar of that poison and pour it down some of those politicians' mouth. Let them see how they feel about it.
The new report recommended only men with cancer be eligible for compensation. 10 years later, only 8 men have received workers' compensation.
To effect what Dr. Harper wanted us to do required a change in the law.
Well, why didn't you change the law?
Well, that's a matter for the whole of government to deal with. That's way beyond the authority of the Minister for Agriculture.
Dr. Randolph Spargo said the men were actually poisoned.
Yes, they were. They were. And they were told that the chemical that they were using couldn't possibly hurt them.
In fact, they were told it was so safe they could drink it.
They could drink it.
I mean, given all that, do you now, all these years later, find it hard to reconcile that they were never compensated, not the great bulk of those men who got sick? If you could...
And indeed, I'll go further than that. I think Dr. Harper's recommendation was the right recommendation.
You're getting a rash on there too. It's all red on that side.
Despite this admission, nothing is likely to change for the children and partners of the sprayers, who believe they are now affected.
Slowly.
3 years ago, Nigel Sinclair was diagnosed with leiomyosarcoma, which is growing on a muscle at the back of his liver. Studies have linked soft tissue sarcoma with toxic exposure from Agent Orange, which was equal parts 245T and 24D.
Just battling to get up and walk around now. Just finding it hard to get out of bed and that, and had to get a new bed now, so... Yeah, and now I'm more confined to a wheelchair. Put my shirt down now.
Mm. None of them wants to watch their son deteriorate like this. And it's something that can't fix, you know. Can't kiss it better, can't put a band-aid on it. And I've just got to watch him. And I don't like to. Got to try and keep strong.
More than 3 decades ago, when Sue Sinclair was pregnant with Nigel, she used to wash his father's chemical-drenched clothes. After Nigel was born, she would put his nappies in the wash with his father's work gear. And Nigel would crawl all over his father and his swag.
Horrible to think that I might have passed something on to my son. Now, I'd take that away from him any day and put it on myself. It's hard.
If dioxin was present, the residual level of dioxin in the clothes need not be very high to be potentially harmful. And these chemicals have got the potential to damage genes and produce an adverse effect in the next generation. And this is a real concern.
Of the 77 workers Dr. Harper interviewed, 58% reported having fertility problems, stillbirths, and premature births. There were 12 reports of birth defects.
Some of the blokes have described what their children look like, and I won't even say what they've said about their own children, what they look like. And
why? What was
they look like monsters, you know, like because of the deformities that they had.
Back in 1976, on the other side of the country, in the small rural town of Yarram in Victoria's Gippsland, a cluster of birth defects was found by a local GP. Dr. Rod Guy told Four Corners he believed the deformities might be linked to heavy spraying of 245T and 24D.
Well, we made a list of the abnormalities, the problems we'd had.
I'd had some really awful things happen, which were really unusual. A baby born without a brain, a baby born without kidneys. Now, in general practice, it's unusual to have serious birth defects.
The Victorian government held an inquiry in 1978.
The disappointing thing was that I thought that the inquiry was really very superficial and, I think, to be honest, rushed to get a political answer.
The inquiry dismissed concerns that the chemicals were potentially dangerous and found that the cluster of birth defects in Yarram could have happened by chance. 2 years later, Professors Ben Salinger and Peter Hall found that there were serious statistical errors with that finding.
Peter Hall is probably one of Australia's best statisticians, and he did that work and showed that the way they did their comparisons would have minimised anything showing up. And when he redid the work using their data, he showed a very high and strong correlation.
So in other words, they were saying that there wasn't a disproportionate number of birth abnormalities.
That's right, yeah. And his results showed that there were a very high proportion of birth abnormalities.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip: what are the secrets of the tahajjud prayers as regards to our ubudiyyah? Now, dear listeners, we've been talking about these supurgatory prayers, these tahajjud prayers that are mustahab, they are recommended, and they are very highly recommended for the believers to recite. These are prayers which are recited after midnight and before the dawn prayers, the fajr prayers. If it is truly very difficult, then it has been suggested by our religious scholars that one can even read these after the Isha prayers or before going to sleep. But still, it is highly recommended. We find that these tahajjud prayers, these nafila recommended supurgatory prayers, have a very special and unique place among all of the recommended prayers. We also find that it has been related in the traditions that all of the divine prophets sent by Allah recited these post-midnight prayers, as well as all of the divinely appointed imams of the Ahlul Bayt of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. We found how it was incumbent upon the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, to recite these tahajjud prayers and how he practically made it obligatory upon Imam Ali to recite these tahajjud prayers. Finally, in this segment, we also talked about verses from the Holy Quran where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala himself alludes directly or indirectly towards these post-midnight prayers, these tahajjud prayers, which can truly enhance, strengthen, and beautify our ubudiyya, our servitude of Allah.
Allah, Allah,
listeners of the program Foresight. My name is Muhammad. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from Munajatul Muhibbin, which means the whispered prayer of the lovers. Stay with me. God, place us among those whose habit is rejoicing in you and yearning for you, whose time is spent in sighing and moaning. Their foreheads are bowed down before your mightiness, their eyes wakeful in your service, their tears flowing in dread of you, their hearts fixed upon your love, their cores shaken with awe of you. O He, the lights of whose holiness induce wonder in the eyes of His lovers, the glories of whose face arouse the longing of the hearts of His knowers. O furthest wish of the hearts of the yearners, O God, O utmost limit of the hopes of the lovers, I ask from you, love for those who love you, love for every work which will join me to your nearness, and that you make yourself more beloved to me than anything other than you, and make my love for you lead to your good pleasure, and my yearning for you protect against disobeying. Oblige me by allowing me to gaze upon you. Gaze upon me with the eye of affection and tenderness. Turn not your face away from me, and make me one of the people of happiness with you and favored position. O responder, O most merciful of the merciful. فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق بكم يحيى إذا زرتم وتفرح باللقى الحدق فإن غبتم فلا صبر ولا جلد ولا رمق ولا رمض فقير ولا.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. In continuation to what we were talking about as far as the tahajjud prayers and its connection with enhancing our ubudiyya, our servitude of Allah, we found that truly these tahajjud prayers, these post-midnight prayers, have a very special place among all of the recommended prayers. And we also found and we talked about how truly these post-midnight tahajjud extra prayers is a sign of love that a human being has towards their creator, because truly it is difficult for the average and normal person to leave the comfort and the warmth of their bed while they have been sleeping comfortably. But what does one go towards? What is it that a human being is moving towards and pursuing when they wake up in the middle of the night to do their tahajjud prayers? In reality, it is going towards a conversation with their creator, a conversation with the one who has given them life and existence, blessings and sustenance. And at what time is this conversation between the created and the creator taking place? In the dark and the quiet of the night. Truly a very mystical and intimate time to spend with the loving Lord of all of creation, individually and as a whole. But as we said, dear friends, always remember, these tahajjud prayers are recommended, so it must not interfere with our obligatory wajib prayers.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is farstoday.com.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي بالرضا والخير، أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
يا الله يا رحمن حقق أماني.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
One example. This example is the story of Shaitan. Right? There's a conversation in the Quran, an important conversation between Shaitan and Allah. Qala ma ma'anaka alla tashjuda idh amartu. God is saying, what stopped you from prostrating when I commanded you? How come you didn't make sajda? Qala, Shaitan speaking. Shaitan said, Ana khayrum min. I'm better than he is. Ana khayrum min. I'm better than he is. What else? Khalaqtani min nar. Shaitan is saying that you made me from fire. Wa khalaqtahu min teen. You made him from clay. So Shaitan, in this story, in the Quran, has ma'rifa. He believes Allah is the Khalid. He's talking to God. But what is that useful for him? No. What else? Sometimes people have yaqeen in the Quran. Yaqeen. Not ma'rifa, yaqeen. And yaqeen doesn't save them. When Musa alayhi salam showed these signs to his people had yaqeen that Musa is talking on behalf of Allah. Yaqeen. It says, وَجَحَدُوا بِهَا. They rejected. وَجَحَدُوا بِهَا وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنْفُسُهُمْ. Their nufus, their souls, their hearts had yaqeen. وَجَحَدُوا بِهَا وَاسْتَيْقَنَتْهَا أَنْفُسُهُمْ ظُلْمًا وَعُلُوَّا. So people can have yaqeen, but that doesn't mean that there's faith.
يا مقلب القلوب ثبت قلبي على دينك يا مقلب القلوب ثبت قلبي.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. And so, dear friends, this is our last segment in our last session talking about the tahajjud prayers and how they enhance our ubudiyyah. It has truly been a pleasure to speak about these tahajjud prayers, and we pray and request Almighty Allah to first and foremost keep us steadfast on the reciting of our wajib obligatory prayers, and then by the grace and favor of Allah, may Allah bless us with the recitation of these tahajjud prayers. Through the constant performance of these tahajjud prayers and other acts of worship in the middle of the night, one can attain a station of perfection. One can attain a purity of soul, and one can attain a proximity to Allah never felt before. Now, what kind of state is this? This is a state in which one begins to possess divine eyes and divine ears and divine actions, in the sense that one will no longer look at anything except that which is good and righteous, nor listen to anything except that which is good and righteous, nor do anything except that which is good and righteous. And so one attains a stage where every supplication of one will become accepted. And this, dear friends, is not something that I am saying. This statement can be found in Thawab al-A'mali, page number 88. And so concluding our great sessions on Tahajjud, go ahead, take that extra step of love, begin your Tahajjud prayers, and remember, it can be done after the Isha prayers, it can be done before going to sleep, it can be done after midnight, it can be done before the dawn prayers. The important thing is to try and start, but always remember, it must not interfere in the wajib obligatory prayers, for the wajib obligatory prayers are one of the pillars of Islam.
إلهنا ما عاد لك مليك كل لمن ملك لبيك قد لبيت لك.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
IRIB English Radio.